Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the February 12th work session of the Gustavus City Council. And it looks like, I'm the Mayor Shelley Owens. We are joined by our City Clerk, who is in Anchorage, Liesl Barker. In the City Hall Chambers, we have members Kyle Bishop, co-host. Brian Taylor's online, Jim Koviak's online, Janine Driscoll's online, Jim. Looks like we've got a couple of community members, and Rachel Patrick is online. And with us here also is Mike Taylor, Council Member Mike Taylor. All righty. Welcome, everybody. We'll go ahead. What we usually do, as I think you probably all know, is at the work session, we'll review the coming up agenda for next Tuesday. And we don't entertain public comment at the work session, but we will at the general meeting. We're hoping to have a presentation by the Alaska Fish Department of Fish and Game about subsistence harvest survey in Gustavus, and we will move on when they arrive. I think we'll probably put them first on the agenda. Are we ready to proceed? Okay. Okay, and also with us is Fire Chief Saul Martinez, and the City Treasurer Ben Sadler is also with us. Looks like what we'll be having in terms of after the approval of minutes and the mayor's request for agenda changes. Okay, hi. Are you Lauren?
Yes.
Okay, good. And we've been joined by Fish and Game. Would you like to come up and sit here with us?
We're going to put you up first.
Okay.
Sorry, I feel lost in my hair.
It's okay. And if you could scooch this over to your, and if you wanted to turn it off, it's just that little button.
Okay.
Turn it show up on the screen.
And I'm Shelley, Mayor, and nice we welcome you.
I'm Emily.
Emily.
Yeah, and I'm Lauren.
Okay, and we are joined by Emily and Lauren from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And let's see, we have their PowerPoint presentation up. Would you like to proceed? Did you want to introduce yourselves first and tell us a little bit about why you're here?
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Lauren Sill. I'm the Regional Program Manager for the Division of Subsistence with the Department of Fish and Game for the Southern Region in Alaska. And Emily Dahl is, you can introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Emily. I'm the Subsistence Resource Specialist for Southeast with the Division of Subsistence.
Yeah, we're both based out of the Douglas office, and we're here to talk about a research project that we have going on in Gustavus, as well as Pelican and Tinicky Springs.
Okay. Yeah. All righty. Okay. Well, take it over.
Okay. I guess you can advance to the next slide. Okay. So I was just going to give a little brief, we'll try to keep this to about 10 minutes, but I was just going to do a brief overview, about the division. We were formed in 1978. We're the social science research branch of Fish and Game. Most of our research is basically to document and investigate the patterns and the uses of wild resources in Alaska. We do this in a variety of different ways, and I'll get more into our specific methods on the next couple of slides, but basically we use a combination of quantitative and qualitative ethnographic research. And one of the things that we do is to quantify basically the harvest of wild resources. And so this graph is just kind of an overview of showing wild food harvests in Alaska. Each bar represents a different region of the state. And then it's based in, is measured in per capita pounds harvested. And so on the far left are urban communities of Anchorage and Juneau, Fairbanks, Ketchikan is in there with about maybe 20 pounds per person, all the way up to the Arctic region, which has, it's about 400 pounds per person of wild food harvests. Rural Southeast is right in the middle. It's the fourth one over. And the different colors represent the different resource categories. So on the bottom is blue, that's salmon. Then the red is non-salmon fish. Green is marine invertebrates, crabs, clams, cockles. And then the purple is land mammals. So you can see for Southeast, the marine resources are super important. They're about 3/4 of the overall harvest averaged across Southeast Alaska. You can go to the next slide. So the kind of research that we do a variety of different types of research projects, things like community baseline harvest studies, where we talk about all the different resources that people might harvest, special topic research, specific, you know, just to hiring eggs in Sitka Sound, something like that. Local and traditional knowledge through interviewing long-term residents of a community or particularly knowledgeable harvesters, and then harvest monitoring. You know, we do some permits and some annual monitoring of fisheries. I think the things I wanted to point out are that most of our projects are partnerships. We really can't do the work that we do without the active participation of communities and the residents. We follow, like, we're guided by the Alaska confidentiality statute, as well as some protocols for the conduct of research in the North. And mainly the takeaways of all that is that all of our research is voluntary. You know, we ask for community support before we submit proposals, which is what we did for this proposal. And then when we come to a community and actually do surveys and we go door to door, everyone has the opportunity to refuse the survey completely with no problem. Or if there are particular questions that we ask during the survey that people don't want to answer, can skip it. And there's nothing bad comes from that. There's no repercussions to that. Also, the data that we collect are anonymous. You know, we have, depending on the community, we might know the household that we're going to, but we have ID numbers associated with them, which is what goes on the survey. And then the survey itself, all the data that goes into a database and gets summarized at a community level. So there's no, there we don't talk about individual households' activities. It's all about a community as a whole. When we're done with the survey or when we're done with the project, we'll come back to the community and present draft results of our data so that the community has a chance to weigh in and see if what we came out with looks right, if there are weird things that came out in the data, maybe some explanations for why the data looks the way it does. And then when we're all done, we'll publish a report and we'll send a 4-page overview of the summary results to all the households in the community. You can go to the next slide.
Another question. How many communities do you do in Southeast?
So it really depends on funding. Right now, we're just doing three. We're doing Gustavus, Pelican, and Tenneke Springs. Okay. Over the last decade, we've done 8 others. And so we work across the state, and most of our funding comes through competitive sources. So it's where there's community interest, where there maybe is a particular need, and where there's funding for it. So for this one in particular, the Fish and Wildlife Service's Office of Subsistence Management has identified that Southeast Alaska, all the communities in Southeast Alaska need updated harvest data, but some of it's particularly old, and Gustavus and Pelican and Tenneke Springs happen to be some of the oldest. We haven't done a survey like this since 1987. And so it's 30 some odd years. So that's why we chose these three communities. It's just because it's the most out of date and we'd like to know what's happening. Lots of change since the 80s, right? Like there's been all sorts of social and economic and demographic changes that likely impact what wild resource harvests look like. So that's one of the main reasons that we're doing this. Next year, we have Prince of Wales Island. We have funding in to do, I think, 4 communities on Prince of Wales Island. So if that comes through, we'll do that. So as a whole, our division can, the southern region, we can handle about 6 to 7 surveys a year just with the staffing we have, because they're really time intensive. Mm-hmm. We have a copy of the survey, but it takes a fair bit of time to do this. And we go, depending on how big the community is, we'll do door-to-door surveys of every single household or a sample of households, but you know, somewhere around 50 to 100 households in each community.
Yeah. Thanks for coming, including us.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about it. So some of the reasons we're doing the project is, like I said, we don't have any data since 1987. And having reliable harvest estimates helps improve state and federal management of wildlife and fisheries, hopefully. And as I said, the surveys document the impact of resource changes and social changes, things that have happened over the last few decades. Advance to the next slide. So this is just an example of the kind of data when we're done of what kind of data we produce. This is from 1987. The pie chart is the breakdown, the composition of the harvest of wild foods. So the majority of it, well, not the majority, but the biggest pie slice came from non-salmon fish, probably halibut, followed by large land mammals, I would assume moose, and then salmon. And then smaller percentages came from the harvest of marine invertebrates, vegetation, and a few birds and eggs. We also ask about marine mammals and small land mammals, but I'm thinking if they weren't on this pie chart, because nobody was harvesting either of those two resources when we were here. And then the bar chart on the lower right-hand corner is the percentage of households using resources in blue or harvesting resources in orange, and it's broken down by resource category. So on the far left would be salmon, then non-salmon fish, large land mammals. I think small land mammals, marine. So I can't actually read all of this on here, but I know vegetation is on the far end. And the main thing really is that, you know, sharing is super important in most communities. And so that there's usually a disparity between how many households are harvesting a resource and how many households are using a resource, because not everybody can harvest all the resources. So the people who can hunt, you know, will harvest moose or deer and they'll share with other households. And so we're interested in that sort of information that's not captured on permits, more than just the number of animals that are being harvested, but also how they get used throughout a community. Go to the next slide. So the specific objectives of this project are three. There's basically to produce a reliable estimate of the harvests and uses of wild resources. How many households are using different categories of wild resources? How many are harvesting them? And how great is the harvest? How many pounds are being harvested? We also want to record the geographic extent. So like, where are people going to search for salmon or to harvest moose? Have those documented. And then finally to document observations of subsistence harvesting practices, trends, and areas used for subsistence activities over time. So I guess you can go to the next slide, get more into those first two project objectives are met through a simple random sample of households. We'll do a survey, and I have a copy of the survey. We'll have the copy of the survey we did in Tinneke, which will be the same as Gustavus, just with a different cover photo, but you guys can take a look through it if you want. And basically it goes through every resource category. There's information about salmon, then large land mammals, non-salmon fish, all the way through to berries and seaweed, as well as harvest area mapping. And it's all just about 2023. So it's really just a snapshot of what happened last year. So to complement that, we also try to interview sort of a longer form conversational interview with long-term residents of Gustavus, active harvesters, something to get some idea of what 2023 looks like compared to 1987 and why that might be, like what's happened over the intervening years. How has community changed? How have harvest activities changed? Places that people can go to try to get a longer picture than just what we'll get from this one survey year. And then local research assistants, we'll try to hire some local people to help us with the survey. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we get towards the end. Advance to the next one. Okay, so the survey itself, as I covered this a little bit, you know, each resource category section, like for salmon or for large mammals, talks about how people are hunting or fishing, you know, what kind of gear are they using, what time of year they're going, if they're going in the fall or in the springtime, about how many fish they're harvesting or how many moose they're harvesting. Are they giving it away to other households? Did they receive the resource from other households? We have a iPad map program that we can document where people are searching for animals or anywhere in the state, as well as there are more qualitative questions on each section to talk about. Like after we kind of document like what happened in 2023, it would be like, well, you know, is this about the same as recent years? Is this more than other years? Is it less than other years? Why is it different? Did you get enough salmon or moose or whatever? And if you didn't, how come? And then there's also a demographics and income section where we talk about like who lives in the household to try to get an understanding of, you know, is it multi-generation households or a lot of kids and their participation in the different activities. And our overall goal, as it says on the bottom, is try to get a holistic understanding of this mixed cash subsistence economy, of how subsistence resources and wage resources play together to allow a subsistence ways of life. We can go to the next slide. Just a little bit more about the harvest mapping thing. So we talk about it at each resource level. And so we get relatively detailed information about, you know, where were you harvesting red salmon or coho salmon, or where were you searching for moose? And we're not looking for super secret spots. We're not asking people to give away, you know, everything. So, and we try, you know, it all gets aggregated out. And it's just community summary information that becomes public at the end, not individual household things. So the next slide will show a we did this in Huna. We did surveys in Huna in 2016. And so this is what a map looks like. You know, they were harvesting deer in that blue area, basically all of Northeast Chichagof. And then they came over to like home shore to harvest, to search for moose. So that's sort of the type of maps that come out of the of what we do. And the maps come back to the community before we publish them too, to make sure that we're not giving away particularly sensitive information. And it's sort of a double-edged sword. Like people can be, this is one of the more, people can be very hesitant to give information about where they're harvesting, which is understandable, but not having, like having data helps us make informed decisions. So like when we get a request to put in a mariculture farm in some water, if we have accurate and recent harvest data, we'd be like, no, it's like super important area for subsistence fishing. Like that's not a great place for there to be a mariculture farm. So not having data makes it difficult. You know, we still end up making decisions. We just make decisions without less information. But so we try to make sure that all the main areas, the areas that are important for harvesting activities are covered in a community without giving away anything too specific or sensitive, I guess. I guess you can go to the next slide. Okay, so I said we have, you know, we try to foster relationships with communities, and Southeast is big. There's, you know, 30 communities or so. And I've been here for 15 years, and this is the first time I've gotten to come to Gustavus because it's just, it takes time. So, you know, we try to create partnerships. Like I said, we try to hire local people to help out with the surveys. We come back for a community data review, and we do our summary distribution that I talked about earlier in the day. And just a reminder that our research is, it's voluntary, it's anonymous, it's confidential. You can go to the next slide. So basically, I guess for us, what's next is that we're hoping to do household harvest surveys in March. And I wanted to run the dates we were thinking of coming to make sure that that works for the community. We'll do a data analysis for all three communities in the spring into the fall. And then we'll have draft data in the fall that we'd like to come back. And I don't know whether it makes sense to come back in the late fall here or if springtime is a better time, but at some point that works, that is reasonable for a community visit, we'll come back and share the draft data, and then we'll write a report and we'll have it published by October.
I have a question. What is the span of time that you're asking these questions about? Because having been here since 1988, there's a lot of cyclical things, and there's a lot of things that Fish and Game have done
mm-hmm.
with harvesting that has changed
mm-hmm.
the amount available to harvest. So I'm curious, I mean, if you haven't done one for 30 some years, the variance of that availability of the various things that mm-hmm. get harvested has changed drastically.
Yeah, for sure. And so the survey itself is just about last year, 2023, January to December. Mm-hmm. But we when we write the report, well, I guess two things. One, that's where we try to have interviews with people who have lived here, like yourself, who lived here a long time and who can talk about like how things have changed and things that they've noticed over their life of either resource abundance or how fish and game regulations have changed access to things or how the development of the park has changed, you know, whatever is going on, how that's changed. And then we also, when we're writing the report, we'll look at fish and game surveys to see like, you know, the moose population was really low in 2023. Like maybe that's why harvest estimates look like that, or it was really high, or, you know, so we try to look at other sources of information to provide more context for just this one snapshot of a year, because it is limited and there's a lot else going on. So we try to expand that and provide context.
Question. Is the 1987 survey available? Are all these surveys online, by the way?
Yeah. Which actually might be the next slide. I was going to talk about where you can find our data. So there we have, So we have called the Community Subsistence Information System. It's the CSIS. And you can go and you can look for harvest by community and pull up Gustavus, and it will tell you in 1987, you know, 100% of households did this, 98% did this. This was the estimated harvest of moose. So the report for 1987 is still in its draft form because it never got published for some reason. But we're working on trying to get that published this year, to at least have a document that's easier to read, but it is on the CSIS. And then the data from this survey will also end up on the CSIS and in a report. And then you can go to the next slide. And I think, I was just gonna say one that like the surveys can be used for any number of things. Like, you know, the community can use it like to create plans, you know, local plans for, or to know how people are using resources or to have this document. But one of the main ways it gets used is when it comes to regulations, either for submitting regulations, you know, if there's some issue that you guys are facing that you would like to see regulations change, anyone can submit a proposal to the Board of Fisheries and you'd have this data to support your position of why you think this regulation change is useful. We use it because we see all proposals that get submitted to the Board of Fisheries or the Board of Game, and we'll comment on them and how they might impact subsistence uses. And so the data that we collect from surveys helps us do that. And our time spent in communities talking to people helps us comment on proposals. And for Southeast, there's a Finfish and Shellfish Board of Fisheries meeting coming up next January in Ketchikan, and proposals are due this April. So I just wanted to bring that to Charles' attention if there are things coming up. The Board of Fisheries meets every 3 years, and so this meeting now isn't going to happen again until 2028. And the Board of Games is going to meet in probably January of 2026. I haven't set the date yet, but it'll be in early 2026. You can go to the next slide. Oh yeah. So this is just a flyer, which we'll try to probably put up around town, that we're looking for people to work with us to, depending on their comfort level, we'll train them in survey administration. We do household surveys in pairs. We try not to send either ourselves or anybody else to someone's house alone, just for safety. And because we ask there's a lot of information that comes, whether you're asking about, people usually don't just say like, oh, I got 20 fish, but they'll say, I got 20 fish. It was a really poor year. Or like, there's usually more information. So we try to take notes during surveys and we try to do mapping. And it's a lot for one person to do. So we go in pairs, and it's invaluable to have local people helping us because for one, they know who we're talking to. They know where to find them. They, you know, they're just the on the ground knowledge that they have. And then it's just, we find it to be really, it's enjoyable to get to work with people and to know individual people better. But it's great to, when they're interested in doing surveys, to have them be able to run through the whole survey on their own, or to do the mapping part. Sometimes the mapping is more interest. And then sometimes people don't want to do surveys or mapping, but are more than happy to help us contact people and get surveys set up. And so that works too. So it's a very versatile job of what people want to do.
Have you considered the possibility of a senior project for a student or two?
Yeah, that would be, so because it's the state, I think we're limited to, we can only work with people who are 18 and older. So I know that can be, sometimes that works, sometimes not, but sometimes we can get, or not around, but I mean, if we work with the city and the city were to be able to, you know, do the official hiring or saying we could work with students. Because we do try to find ways to work in schools where that makes sense and where there's interest and desire, both of the kinds of jobs we do and the kind of work that we do, and to involve, you know, we've done projects where students interview their grandparents about subsistence. And like, so doing that kind of stuff, I think would be great. Yeah.
And how do you select your sample, and what percentage of the population would you be sampling?
So I believe we're going to sample 50% of Gustavus, but that is one thing I was hoping to come away with this trip with a better understanding of, just how many people live, how many households are year-round residents. I imagine there's quite a seasonal difference in the summertime, which is why we do our surveys now, because we're trying to get people who live here year-round for the most part. We have a cutoff of 6 month residency. But I think that there's somewhere, based on the census, maybe somewhere around 200 households living here. And if that's the case, then I think we came up with 96 households, but that may change based on the final number of households. And the way we choose is, it's just a simple random sample. Like, we either put in all the names of people or all the addresses or whatever we have to identify what it is, and then just have Excel randomly place them. And then we just take the first, you know, we go through the first, you know, if we're looking for 100 households, we'll pull the first 100 names, go talk to everybody. If they don't want to do it or they're out of town, we'll pull more names until we get to the sample size that we're looking for. Yeah. And then the interviews are not random. Those would be based upon, you know, suggestions from you guys or suggestions from our local researchers or from people we talk to, of just who would be useful for us to talk to. And then we would do interviews with those kind of people who are also willing to talk with us. Yeah. Okay. And then I think that's all. I think the next slide is just our names. Yeah. So that's all. If you guys have any other questions.
Are there any clarifying questions from council members in the audience on Zoom? And I don't see any hands up. And we'd like to welcome Cal Cassapet back to the council and know that that you've worked on this project, I believe, in its early inception.
I sit on the regional advisory
For record, Calvin Cassapet, local resident here in Gustavus. I sit on the regional advisory council, and all I did was suggest that this project be funded. the Federal Subsistence Board made the final determination on projects. Yeah, I support this.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.
For joining us, and we'll next see you in March, or we'll be here before then.
Well, yeah. So we're actually tomorrow going to have like a community open house kind of thing at the community center. So we'll be hanging out there from 6 to 8 for anyone who wants to stop by. We have some materials and our survey and just a little bit about who we are. A lot of people don't know about the Division of Subsistence, and so part of that. And to hopefully talk to some people and kind of learn about what are some of the issues and how people feel and where people are harvesting, just kind of help us orient to like to Gustavus, because we don't know a whole lot about it. So hopefully we can share our information and people will come and talk to us. And and then, yeah, we're planning on coming back on the ferry in March. I think it comes on the 11th. So we were going to try to see if we could fit our surveys into the ferry schedule. So come on the 11th and the 18th.
Did you want to distribute the brochures in advance of when you come back in March?
Yeah, I think that we have
some flyers with me now.
Yeah, we have some flyers about the fact that, you know, say like the surveys are happening and then the ones for LRAs. So we were going to hang some up around town, but I don't know if it's too far in advance, or we could leave some and maybe get some put out, or if there's I don't know if you guys do an email distribution or if there's any sort of thing like that that might work for, yeah.
If you have Lauren, it's Liesl Barker, the city clerk. If you can just email me some of them, I can make sure they get out electronically as well as posted around town.
Okay, great. Yeah, we can do that.
All right. Thank you.
I was going to say the
same. Well, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy your stay here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure, we will.
For having Love us.
It. Yeah.
Okay, we'll be moving on to the reviewing the draft agenda. There'll be staff reports from the Disposal and Recycling Center, the City Treasurer, and the City Administrator. To tell the truth, I can't exactly remember whether they give reports. Do we give reports during the work session or wait until the general meeting?
They'll give the reports at the meeting.
Thank you.
And don't forget your approval of the prior minutes.
And don't forget what?
The first item on the draft agenda is to go over the general minutes from the previous meeting.
Thank you. Thank you. So, all right. And they're pulled up on the screen there. I don't know if everyone has had an opportunity to review them. Are there... Perhaps we could scroll through them and see if anyone has any questions or comments.
I'll just chime in that I've reviewed those and they look to me.
Okay, thank you, Brian. And thanks also to City Clerk Liesl for putting in the time checks on this, so it makes it easier for people to if they want to listen to the audio portion of the council meetings, where to find the information.
And my appreciation for that. That's nice.
Okay, no clarifying questions from council members that are here or in the audience. Then looks like we have the looks like the city treasurer has posted a copy of his written report in the packet. And then we will move on to the consent agenda. The first item is FY24. Doesn't have a number yet. Closing capital projects. Ben, is this something that you would like to describe?
It's just an NCO with the new process of moving the money between the checking accounts, the AMLIP accounts, etc. These are projects that were completed in 2023 or at the I think they were all completed at the in 2023, and now I'm just moving the money back from the current account. And also there was some money, I think $9,000+ in one of the projects that was still in the checking account that due to bad math on my part when I created the current AMLIP account. So I'm just moving the money back into long-term because the projects are closed.
Okay. And the next two items, 5 and 6, are to approve the CFP capital improvement project, project nomination short forms for the DRC Belfol expansion and the fire department heating system. Would you like to address those as well, describe those as well, or is there someone else that would like to talk about them?
I think there someone else would probably be a better candidate, maybe Mike or Sol.
Okay, how about the Belfol expansion? Kathy, did you want to talk about that?
Well, yeah, we want to move that forward because we need that to happen sooner rather than later. And once it's approved, we can hopefully incorporate it into some other funding requests if possible. Ian's already been working with John on permitting so that the permits are in place as we're seeking funds to move forward with it. We could potentially phase part of it in at a time, like the fence ordering, or but we're just trying to get it all lined up so that even if it didn't happen this year, which we're hoping it will, if it didn't happen this year, we would have it available to pursue a funding stream, even though I think we could do some of it ourselves. Okay. And we will need to do some of it ourselves if we don't find the funding stream, because we're going to run out of room in the other bail fit. So we definitely have to get moving on that. And so we just tidied it up a bit and it'll be there to present.
Okay. And the fire department heating system, I'm not sure who would like to address that. Sol? Fire Chief Sol? Okay. Thank you. Janine, did you have a clarifying question?
I do, just, and this is just maybe a housekeeping thing. On these documents, I noticed that there's no date as to when they're created or made. And I think it would be helpful, because some of these things do go on and for several years, that I think it would be helpful to have on the form when it was initially written.
I think that's a good suggestion. Is that something that could be accomplished?
On the bottom of the form, it does have date approved. I think once it approved, they're written down the date.
And that would be?
I think it would look right there.
Okay.
I think that is what it is, right?
I see, right down at the very bottom. Okay. That's on the.
Yeah.
You're talking about the documents that are included with the project nomination form?
Exactly. I think that just right up at the top, because the date that gets approved gets put on a different copy of it as opposed to the original one that gets put in. And so I think it would be easy just to add a line and have the date. And perhaps even it would be helpful to know who was writing it, who was putting it forth. So which department, whether it was, you know, that was putting this project, writing the scoping document.
I guess I'm not sure of what you're talking about. Are you talking about the short form itself or the attached drawings and maps that may be part of the attachments?
I'm talking about the main document itself.
Hmm. Kathy, go ahead.
So there's a footer at the bottom, and it has the department. It's got the project name. It's got that there's an attachment. It has a submitted by and a meeting date and approved or not approved. And that'll get updated as soon as the meeting's done. I mean, we could be putting in the submitted by ahead of time in the meeting date. You know, this is the first one of these Ian's done, so. But the footer is on all the pages of the document with all that information.
Does that satisfy your concern, Janine?
No, I still think it would be a good thing to have just the date that's written on the original form, because this form could get, someone could copy it and send it to somebody else. And this, to have it be when it's submitted and approved, etc., is fine to have it on the footer. But I just think that it makes sense on any form to have at the top of the form the name of the project, the date it's written, and who's writing it. And so that's just my suggestion.
Okay.
Madam Mayor.
Yeah.
A longer form has a lot of that stuff on the top, but it doesn't have a date. It'd be very easy to just add that in. Mm-hmm. And we could send that form out again with the date added onto it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with the short form. I don't ever use the short form. I just use the long one. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you want us to move the footer to the top of the form then instead, so we don't have to fill it out twice? Or
Mike, you're saying that so the long form doesn't have this information in a footer?
Well, actually, it does have a footer. I just never paid attention to the footer. So, mm-hmm. But up at the top of the form, it has the department, the contact, the contact's email and the phone number.
Mm-hmm.
So that covers most of it. All we'd have to do on that one is add the date. And, there's nothing sacred about these forms. Anybody using them can put the date in too. You can add a line if you want.
Yeah, no, I'm not recommending that we change the forms. If the additional information is added to the long form, I'm fine with that.
Okay, that's the long form. Two of these are the short form.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I'm saying is either that or, put a routing slip cover on it saying it was discussed at this meeting on this date and submitted by this department or whatever, so it's right there for those who need to see it.
I think that's in the footer, though. It says what the meeting date was, so the person would be able to go back and listen to the audio clip of the discussion.
So how does the footer get filled in? Is it filled in electronically, or is it just jotted down on a piece of paper?
It's something that I add electronically once it has been either approved or not approved, after the general meeting when it's spoken about, and then it's saved like that. That is the hard copy.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. The fire department heating system, Chief Soul.
So yeah, like I said, the heating system in the fire, current heating system right now, it's basically eating itself alive due to the corrosive byproduct it has, and the what was neutralizing it at one time is no longer working, and it was recommended by Mark Berry to basically replace it essentially, and in that discussion we decided to it would be best to put at least one Toyo stove with a heat pump upstairs. There was some thought of maybe doing two Toyo stoves, but I think we landed on doing one for now and see how it goes. Just to see how, yeah, because we always add more. It's kind of hard to take away. So that essentially is it. It's just like trying to preserve the the heating system in the garage, make sure the stuff that in there doesn't freeze over the winter time. The large reason I didn't want to just go with just heat pumps is because that is a large building in itself, and it would take quite a bit of power, or even quite a bit of heat pumps to keep it heated. So Toyo stove has a tendency to do a little bit more efficient to heating those kind of like large areas, and the lack of insulation in there as well, because it is a garage. I'm trying to heat, not necessarily a house. So the heat pump, hopefully it'll just be just upstairs with the Toyo stoves downstairs, with maybe an optional heat pump downstairs to maybe heat it up where we, if we were doing some work downstairs. But
yeah, I'd suggest you use, you know, one heat pump with two discharge units, one upstairs, one downstairs, and just size it big enough. So then you'd have two sources downstairs. You'd have your Toyo plus the heat pump, and you can run either or both. Or
yeah, and that was one of the options I kind of expressed. And like, I just don't want to be solely on heat pumps.
Yeah, you know, I think you do need a backup oil.
Yeah, especially since we already have the tank there.
Yeah.
And I think in the end, it would be more efficient than the way we currently have. The ability to keep the garage at like a 50 degree for most of the year. If it gets hotter, it gets hotter, but because I know the summertime it lands 60, and well, I'm not gonna and up in the where we work, the office area, keeping it up at 60-65, I think it'd be more efficient in the end, just because there's no need to keep the garage at the same temperature where the office is, if we're not working in there all the time.
Are there any other clarifying questions? Anyone, any of the council members online?
Yeah, I wanted to chime in. It says in the scoping document that the estimate has some more details, and I don't know if I see the estimate attached. That wasn't in our capital improvement, or in our last meeting we had. I was curious to kind of look over the estimates on that one, if those are available.
I did submit it with the document. I'm not sure if it made it into the packet. I can email it to the Liesl, and she can send it out again if she needs to, but it was Mark Sperry's estimate. I think it ranged around like $20,000, I think was.
Yeah, Liesl sent that out to council members separately before the last meeting. I believe the attachment of the estimate was included in that email, but it's not here in this packet.
The project cost is on page 26. Is that what you're talking about? The total cost is $22,859?
No, there's an estimate from Barry Specialty Contracting that was attached.
Ah, okay.
And to clarify that estimate, I think, was just kind of like a broad, like, this is kind of what I would do. I think it does include, did it include two Toyo stoves? But
yeah, it was like the Cadillac plan. So we had costs to go by. And then we looked at starting out smaller
yeah, now, with one just, stove, yeah.
Just because that boiler is precarious enough that we might want to just get the Toyo stove funded sooner rather than later, and then we can go along with the rest of the scoping document as a phase two.
Will this be incorporated into a longer project description, the project, the scoping document?
Well, what would it,
other than the short form?
I mean, I could write in the long form. Mm-hmm. The short form was developed for the CIP.
To get it on
the nomination, just get it to get it in front of you. If you mm-hmm. want to get a scoping document set up for the next council meeting, not general on the March meeting,
mm-hmm.
something that I can set up mm-hmm. if that is preferred.
Do we have a procedure for proceeding from short to long form?
We don't really. I think this one's a small enough project that I don't know that it needs the long form. I do feel like the landfill, Balefill one needs the long form because mm-hmm. it's got some environmental concerns to use the check boxes for. And mm-hmm. I told Ian I'd work with him on that one. Yeah. But this one was minimal enough to where it didn't seem to me to need a long, you know, a longer form.
There, I mean, in filling out the long form, I do feel like I agree with Kathy here in a sense, not because I want to do less work, it's because I think there are some, it'll be repeating some information over and over again, just answering those questions.
I guess I'm wondering, Lisa, would it be possible to get the that attachment included in the packet?
Yeah, I was looking for it in my email. I was looking for it in my email. I have not found it yet. So Sol, if you could just send it to me again, and then I'll make sure it's in the packet. And then as far as the difference between the long plan and the short plan, the only thing in our policy is it says the more complex should use the longer the project development form versus the project nomination short form.
I have a couple questions.
Okay, go ahead, Mike.
Well, to begin with, I think this is a pretty big project. And normally for a project like this, you would use a consulting engineer to determine what's needed, develop, you know, project specifications and contract documents. How are you planning to bid this, and who's going to do the contract documents? Who's going to do the actual design? Determine what's going to be bid and so forth.
Well, that's what this is, a plan, and it's the start of the plan. So whether we use John Barry or not, I was initially just trying to get something in front of you guys, because this is something that needs to be done, because the boiler we have could break next month, next week, next year. So it was one of those things, like, right now we need to get something in place, kind of plan. Whether we use John Barry as just an engineering scope, we could talk to him, see if he has any experience trying to figure out a plan, but I don't know.
Barry's a civil engineer, he's not mechanical.
Yeah,
so this is a mechanical engineering project. And I think what you need to do is engage a mechanical engineering consultant.
So if we provide some funding.
This may be helpful for, you know, it gives us a good idea, sort of what we're looking at for what might be done. But I don't think you've got any cost in here for design work. And
I'm not sure what you need. I guess in a sense that would be nice to know, that, okay, as far as like energy costs, our energy efficiency plan, that would be good. And I guess if we want to throw some more money in the end, currently we don't, I can look, I'm open for recommendations. In the end, this is just a kind of a plan, and like we can set up funding if we can, but I can talk to other engineering companies, since there's currently not much money in the budget right now to just spend that money. We have to do like get a quote and get an NCO if we want to start doing that.
You'd have to put out a request for proposal for some, design consultants. You only have to put it out to maybe three or less even. And they would do an analysis of the building, you know, heat calcs on the building to determine what the load, what the heating requirement is on the building. And then design, you know, specify equipment that would meet that heat demand. And so that's kind of what mechanical engineer does, consulting engineer does. They are available in Juneau. And so that's one thing that the longer form has some more questions about, that sort of thing. So I think it's the longer forms maybe a better one to use, because it asks you what do you need a design consultant, and what do you think it's going to cost, and so forth. So I think that you got a good start here, but I'm not sure you've necessarily got enough money in it to do a proper design, and you'll also have to be thinking about how you're going to contract it. Who's going to write the contracting documents? It could be your consultant, or it could be done in-house, and so forth.
Well, yeah, I think Kathy has.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Kathy's got. Maybe she's already thought this out.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I mean, it's not a complex building, and I would think, you know, a contractor with 30 plus years of experience installing these things in town may have already put some thought into it without having to go to the expense and the delay and all of that extraneous, what I feel to be extraneous planning. If, you know, somebody who's been installing these things forever and ever seemed to think that they would suffice. So, I mean, a mechanical engineer is going to cost $10,000 to do that building.
It might, yes.
Yeah.
But they're less likely to make a mistake. Mark's a contractor. He's not an engineer. And, you know, he does have it. I mean, he did my house, did a good job on the mechanical system. So, you know, but, you know, he's not doing heat calcs on the building, I don't think. And he may do some, you know, sort of guess at it, but it could be, you know, you could end up not meeting the heating requirements in the building. So that's something with a consultant, you'd have a little more confidence that the constructed, well, for one thing, you'd have design specifications that you can put out to bid. And then secondly, you'd have some confidence that the constructed product is going to meet your expectations. And the design consultant might look at the building too and say, well, in addition to heating, you can save some heating if you fix these heat leakage problems in the building. And so here's an option for that. So they'll look at it a little more holistically.
I think the trouble is though, there is that little bit issue of the heating. Mark already did state fixing it that it may not last this winter. And if we are going to create delays, maybe putting at least one toilet stove and then going towards the engineering plan might be a better plan, because going that engineering route, while it may be a good idea, maybe a delay that we don't need. It could be very well better to go on the cautionary route of getting the toilet stove in, getting that placed. If we want to spend more money, heat pumps or more, if we need another toilet stove, we can add more, because we already need, we're going to need at least one. Yeah.
If you're really worried about whether the system's going to make it through this heating system season, then putting a Toyo in there might, you know, be a good idea, be a good first step. Either upgrade the Toyo or, you know, replace it with a bigger one or whatever, if you needed to, if the design told you that.
Yeah. I'd just rather go with someone who has 30 year experience than my own experience, because I don't have that experience. So I do trust Mark Berry's opinion in the sense of, like, he is the only person that can work on this boiler.
Yeah.
And he did say, like, if these certain parts break, we can't replace them.
And he clearly knows the building well.
And I think Kyle has a comment.
Yeah, and there's a couple of questions.
Yeah, are we beholden to go through that extent of the process with engineering? I know one thing that I've heard from the public is sometimes we go a little too far in that for a rather simple need with some of the projects that we've done. Granted, you know, obviously, like, bridge work and culverts and big things need it, right? But it's something as simple as a Toyo and a heat pump to fix it before we're out of heat over there. Like, what's the square footage of the building? It really doesn't seem that complex to me.
To me, I do agree with Kyle. It's not, I don't know the rules of the city all that well. I think that's more for the Mike's and Shelley or Kathy to answer.
Anyone, I know that's kind of like our procedure, at least since I've been on the council, is that we go through that for a lot of our projects. For some of the smaller things, like, oh, do we have to do that? Do we have to go to that extent? Or is it just nice to?
I mean, I do think it might not be, if we have the money, it might not be a terrible idea. In a sense of, if we do get the design plans and we follow them, that means that we know it's going to work. Or if it doesn't, then we can talk to the engineers, like, what the hell? Yeah. but there is two sides of it. Yes, I do agree with Mike in the sense that if we get the engineering plans and stuff, that we know it's going to work, versus going on what 30 years experience gets you, which also is good too. I mean, he knows Southeast, he knows Gustavus weather. And he does know that building. I think he's one of the original volunteers that was, I'm not sure he was helped building the building, or I think he did or something like that. But
yeah. I think he was the fire chief as well.
Yeah. So like, yeah, he knows that building very more than I do. So I think there's two sides. Yeah. I do believe that sometimes the city does go over its chance of we over planning some things. I'm not going to deny that, but I think there is a benefit and a downside for it each. But
yeah, I don't think this one, you know, some of our buildings have life safety code requirements, so they require structural engineer and approval by the fire marshal, like even the bike shelter at the library did. And so that drives that for putting in a Toyo. No, probably not.
Is that a hand up? Oh, Liesl, do you have your hand up?
I do. Two things. One, if you guys in City Hall can kind of eat your mics, it'd be great. I have my volume at 100 and sometimes I can hardly hear you. And secondly, per our policy for grant proposals and capital requests of $15,000 and $1 or greater, it needs to have the project scoping and development form. That means the long one, it says complete to the extent applicable. Just so that kind of answers that. So the short form gets it moving on our CIP, but it really should have the long form.
Thank you, Liesl.
Yep.
It's easier to do the long form too. And, you know, usually I do one in an hour.
Like Sol said, it's like, it is duplicating a lot of the information on the short form. So in theory, it's like, oh, why should I have to do this when most of the information is there? But then you're just clarifying and specifying some additional.
Yeah. And I guess in a sense it will, like, okay, I just need this specific question answered and I call this question. Yeah.
Okay, well, shall we move on to item 8, approve the scoping document for Wilson Road South End Drainage, Mike?
Sure. This was a project that our mayor has wanted to do for a long time, and I've been slow at getting to it. So she wanted to have it on our CIP for the year, so they needed a scoping document. Now, so what I did using the long form was to describe the project as best as I can at this stage. And I don't have, you know, I took a pretty wild guess at costs. You're just pretty much off the top of my head, you know, and I haven't really tried, you know, in getting this in on a short schedule, I haven't had time to actually try to estimate it more closely. And then, of course, your final cost is really whatever gets bid for it. And it'll make a difference, for example, on whether we're using the culverts that we've got in stock or buying new culverts for the project. Things like that will vary this cost. But at least for getting it onto the CIP list and having a, you know, a document that describes it, that's where it is.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Did you want to comment, Kathy?
Well, I know Liesl had said, you know, we don't have to do the reports until the general meeting, but in the past, if people had them prepared already, then sometimes they gave them and Ian came so that he could give his. So okay. I don't know if you want to do that or wait, but Yeah, sometimes we gave them and then we gave them again at the general meeting, mm-hmm. or we updated them.
Okay. Why don't we finish up with item 8, the Wilson Road, okay. and then move on to Ian?
Okay.
Is there anything else that you wanted to?
Well, just, you know, if you're not, I didn't give you the basic scope is to try to improve drainage from about far away down to Four Corners. And the problem for that section is not water flowing down Wilson Road from the gravel pits, because before it gets there, it gets into the other bigger ditches. As long as the bigger ditches can handle it, and we still don't know whether that, you know, Glenn's ditch will really handle all the flow that we can get in coming down Wilson sometimes. But so this is aimed at improving, you know, putting ditches in on both sides of the road and culverting the driveways. But the other thing that we have to figure out is where the water goes once it gets to Four Corners, and there's no good answer to that. And I've had some initial discussion with Jeff Jarvis, and because once we get down there, we're into the DOT right away. And it's, if you happen to look at the properties around there when we had that really heavy rainfall and snowfall 3 weeks ago or so, you may have noticed that some of them were totally flooded, and because there's no place for the water to go right now, and it can't go east along Wilson or along Gustavus Road very well, because that's at 90 degrees to the land slope, and actually when it gets down to Marchbanks, it's like goes slightly uphill before it gets to Glenn's Ditch. So that's not a good route. The other routes are possibly going down Dock Road or Gustavus Road to the river, and both of those take work with the state, and it's going to take us a while to figure out how we're going to, you know, where the water is going to go. But the project I've described only gets it to Four Corners, and Fleeks certainly don't want it in their yards. So mm-hmm. they've got more than enough there now. Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot of work to do on this.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. So I don't know if you see that I do have my hand raised. So I have a comment on this form. I'm seeing we have an updated form that includes the PFAS question, and I'm not seeing that on this form. And so it looks like maybe instead of using the newest form, you maybe used an older one. And I think that this is something that the PFAS is going to be in something that needs to be documented that we have looked at.
Sure, I could add that. I just pulled up my template that I'd used before and I forgot to add that line back in. So, we can do that as well. I'm not sure that PFAS is going to be much of an issue if we're just ditching the sides of the existing road and putting in culverts, we can sure put it on the form and give it some more thought.
Right. Yeah. Cause I think it's just, you know, a good thing that's, we have it on all of them, especially, you know, I don't know if people are thinking in terms of anytime you're talking water flow, there's the potential to be moving water from one place to the next. And so it'd be good if we make sure that we change the templates and use the current one.
Okay. And it looks like Liesl has a question. Or has her hand up?
Yeah, just to kind of piggyback on that, these forms I know were brought in by resolution, so that might be something that the council needs to change with resolution. So that's something that maybe we can look at all these little changes we'd like to do, if a council member would like to take that on, and then we can get that maybe in the March meeting to update it.
Right, thank you for that suggestion.
But we've already had one that had the PFAS on it. So that one was most likely a form that would have been approved or
that
not?
That was not. Mike did that after we had a couple citizens who had concern with it. So he just added it, but it was never formally updated with a resolution or approved.
Okay, thanks.
Can I provide a little bit of a
Yes.
So because of the PFAS question, we got a quote from Shannon and Wilson, which was quite expensive. I think that was brought up last time, that the cost of that, and we were going to wait until we put it into the project for the full cost of the project.
Talking about Glenn's Ditch.
The Glenn's Ditch, yeah. That's all part of the drainage, right? I mean,
no.
Okay, so
this begins downstream. Well, the big ditch along Wilson Road that comes down as far as Chase Drive, and then at that point it connected to what was known as the Mills Ditch, because Dan Mills built it
right
years ago, and then that goes just about to Far Away, and then turns into the Glenn's Ditch system, where it empties there into the airport pond ditches, which follow around the south side of the runway there and connect to Glenn's Ditch. And so this is not going to connect to that. And
but I thought
we're not going to put water from this into Glenn's Ditch, I don't think.
But I thought the concern about the PFAS was in Glenn's Ditch, not in this project.
Yes, but I think what she's saying is this is an area, the general area is an area that has been a PFAS concern, you know, from Far Away, you know, there, that is the area that the plume actually moved through. So it's worth considering. She makes a very good point here to consider that in the project.
Okay. I guess I must have missed it for this project, because I thought the main driver and why we got Shannon and Wilson to do those samples last week was because of the comments that came in.
Right, for Glenn's Ditch, which is a separate project, you know, and
okay.
We're not as far along on this project. And if we decide that we want to do some sampling, you know, at some point we may have to, you know, hire them to do it.
Okay.
All right. And Tom, I see your microphone. Did you want to speak? I don't see a hand raised.
Well, I asked you before. I don't know how to raise my hand, and nobody told me. But yeah, I can't hear you. Like Liesl said, nobody's speaking into their mics. Thank you.
I've been as close to my mic as I ever am, so I don't know if we got a problem with the system.
Liesl said that they could hear the other two speakers.
Yeah, I especially can't hear you, Mike.
I'm sorry, who can you hear and who can you not hear?
I especially cannot hear Mike.
Okay.
Well, how's this? Is that better?
That's better. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll speak closer. Okay.
Okay, we're good. Thank you, Ben. Okay, moving on to item number 9. Liesl, would you like to talk about the certificate of records destruction?
Sure thing. Kind of just kept going through and looking for more records. I found other records. I want to say, if you click on it, yep. It's accounting, payroll, and HR stuff that I had to clear out from the cabinet that I didn't get to in time for the last one, and it needs to be shredded. So just another item on the list.
Thank you, Liesl. Any questions? No questions.
And really quick, Shelley, I also failed to add the COLA resolution to the consent agenda. I will update it for the next meeting. But I was wondering if we had a second and I could screen share so you guys could see it.
Will this be for the consent agenda, did you say?
Yes, I believe so, unless it's a hot topic, and then I would move it down. But
okay.
I believe it would probably be a good consent consent agenda.
All righty. Did you say you wanted to screen share so we could take a look at it?
Yes, I am working on that right now. All right, can you guys see that?
Yes.
Sure can.
And I believe Ben can speak to this.
Okay, you like that? Oh, sure. Go ahead, Ben. Yeah.
So basically this time of year, we go to the Anchorage Consumer Price Index and according, based on our policy and procedure, and we find out what the percentage of the cost of living increase is in Anchorage. And then we create this resolution. So all I did was get the figures off the internet and plug them into this resolution. The council can choose to approve a COLA increase. We'll add that into the budget or can choose to ignore this. However, it's not something the council has to approve, but it's I prepared it in case the council was interested. So it's just something we do every year this time of year.
Okay. Thank you, Ben.
I think we usually approve it. Mm-hmm.
Are there any other clarifying questions about the COLA resolution? All right. So now, Ian, did you want to come forward and give your report?
Good evening, Council and Mayor Shelley. I just wanted to summarize my report for you guys really quick. Labor this quarter. I was able to have one individual apply, and it was really nice having some help while they were here. Unfortunately, they had to travel out of state for some personal reasons, which leaves me solo again. For equipment, I made some memorable repairs this quarter, such as fixing the ejection mechanism on a Cramalot baler finally. That was really nice, and I was able to do some maintenance on our glass crusher and try to squeeze a little more life out of some components that just wear out over use. I've been using a pair of 12 volt car batteries wired in series to be able to make these repairs with welding, and that's been very interesting, and I have mixed opinions because there's no real control, so
that's right.
I am considering maybe purchasing a smaller welder, but I would have to install some new 240 volt receptacles because we only have one in a relatively odd location, so it's not very helpful. One of the other big things is my trip to Seattle, which I went down there to extract the offending item out of one of the radioactive bales, which basically got to AML's yard there, and after about 30 minutes of ripping scrap out of the bale, I found the offending object, which was an old RPM gauge, and it ended up not posing any danger, and it was safe to handle just latex gloves. So it was nice to find that out. And I considered my mission successful after that. I was able to visit Seattle and Iron Metal Works and take a tour of their plant, which was very exciting. I definitely learned a lot and I saw a lot, but some of the most important things I was able to bring back home from that was how to better sort and process certain materials so we get better value out of them, such as not over processing or under processing materials such as copper or aluminum. And I also found out that they've been in operation for over 100 years, and that really impressed me. Mm-hmm. Last month I put together a scoping document for expanding the landfill, and that is a fairly large but simple project, and I hope that can be approved by council and we can proceed with that in a timely manner. It'll definitely change the appearance of the area quite dramatically, but I do plan on doing the best I can to hide it and to manage it in a way that it doesn't appear to be much more than a growing hill from the outside. And that concludes my summary. Does anybody have any questions? Okay.
Does anyone online have any questions for Ian about his report? Okay. Janine, are you?
Yeah, thanks. I unmuted as I was finding the raise your hand thing. So the question, first of all, I'm just thank Ian for all of his persistence and work on this. And yes, that was an expensive pair of latex gloves you needed to move that offending object. But my real question is in terms of the fundings, is this something that we can fund? Are we planning to fund in house? And maybe this is a question that goes to someone other than Ian, but or is it something that we still need to, is dependent upon writing grants and getting funding? Or is this something that we fund from in-house?
At this point in time, we haven't applied for any grants, but there is some potential opportunities for that that I'm hoping to pursue if it gets approved. Otherwise, it's looking like the project will only cost approximately $100,000, according to all of my calculations. So I do see it as being viable to fund it in-house, but of course I would like to pursue for grants to help fund it as well.
Great. And then I just have a question just in terms of general procedures of that. Is that something that if we do go ahead funding in-house, that grants can be like written after the fact or during the fact, and or in terms of grants, do they need to be approved and gotten the money before a project is started? So I guess my question is, if we start and we decide we're going to pay for it, but can we also at the same time be pursuing grants that if we get them, then go back into our funds?
I'm not 100% sure on that. I asked Zach Gibonacci, which is the Southeast Alaska Department of Environmental Control guy, and he sent me an email with 5 or 6 different opportunities, and I only briefly scanned through them.
So we've had 2 or 3 grants out for stuff we've done to the landfill or to the DRC. Typically, you can't do it and then write a grant to get reimbursed. That's the kind of thing you have to plan for and put ahead of time. But this is why we need to go back and do the long form with that grid I was telling you about, Ian, just because it's a bigger, more expensive project and it does have environmental impacts to it. So we are going to be updating that. There's competitive grants and then there's non-competitive grants, and it might be prudent to fund this one as much as possible in-house or in phases and try and maybe go after a smaller grant for a specific thing like just the fencing material or something like that. But I would rather submit the larger composting facility grant because it's 4 times the amount of cost or 5 times the amount of cost to something like this. So just as an update, when I was in Juneau, I met with Ora Landau, who works for HDR. And HDR is a national company. They do a lot of consulting work. They're 100% employee owned. They have architects, they have engineers, they have asset management people, they have grant writers, they have project delivery, planning and consulting people. And so they have a lot of people who can help put grants together because they have the expertise within the company. And I met with her and I told her about many of our projects. And we agreed she would give me a proposal to help us with planning grants, to help us with our grants, to help us prioritize some of the things. I mentioned to her about the area-wide roads planning interest. So there's just so much of this going on right now with the infrastructure funds that it needs somebody that's all they focus on to be able to harness our options better than... I was I was doing a lot of it, but now that we have the borough activity and a bunch of the other stuff, we actually need somebody that just does that for a profession. And so I'll be probably putting forth an NCO to get some help in that area.
Thanks.
So that's the long story. I'm just telling you that, like, we're trying to get grants for stuff, but it's becoming a little overwhelming.
Okay. Any other questions from anyone? Great. Number 10 is the, thank you, Ian, FY24-10 NCO Introduction Surplus Transfer to AMLIP Capital Project Long Term. And here comes Ben.
Yes, this is, say it again. Which one are we on?
It's the introduction of the surplus transfer to AMLIP Capital Project Long Term, introduced January 16th, FY24-10 NCO.
Right. Okay. So that's where I was confused. This isn't an introduction. We introduced this in January. This month will be the public hearing for this. This was the NCO to move the surplus funds, $200,000 from the checking account into the AMLIP account in order to be in compliance with our AMLIP policy and our restricted unrestricted funds policy.
Okay. So we'll just need to change the title on this item, Liesl, if you are listening.
It's been noted.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're moving I'm sorry.
No, I'm making sure the next one's not for me before I step
away. You may want to stay, it's gravel pits.
That's what I thought.
Okay, we have moved from ordinance for public hearing through unfinished business down to new business, and number 11 is the award of the gravel pit contracts.
Okay, so we sent out solicitation for our gravel pit contracts, and we received three, one from Gustavus Landscaping, one from Glacier Bay Construction, and one from Fairweather Construction, the three construction companies that have in the past had gravel pit contracts. And so I have taken they've each asked for specific amounts of gravel under the amount that we allotted for the year, and I have created their contracts. The council just needs to approve that at the general meeting, and then I will award the contracts to the contractors.
Thank you, Ben. Any questions for Ben? Okay. And next up is a resolution, draft resolution, which I apologize, I didn't get into the packet that I sent out to everyone late this afternoon. It's about a resolution regarding the opposition on the City of Hoonah Borough petition. And I'm not real sure exactly how to proceed on this. Borough petition was provided to, but I'm sorry, did you, I sent it out, I think about 3:30 or 4 o'clock.
Kyle, I have it ready if you want to share the screen share with me.
Oh, please. Thank you. That'd be great.
I got it on my screen here.
Oop, I just see us now. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you, Liesl. Okay, we've been discussing this for a bit. We had the Local Boundary Commission hearing. We circulated the PowerPoint of the Local Boundary Commission. And we have a 4-inch binder, which I'll return to City Hall if people want to look at the exhibits. And a couple of us, in particular, Mike and I have been doing a deep dive into this. I've got an Excel spreadsheet that's 8 pages long where I went through all of the main regulatory standards, looking for comments from community and community members and other communities, and location of where it was referenced in the petition and documents. And if anyone wants to go over them with me, I welcome you to sit down with me. I've been working on a draft of the our public comment. What I'd like to do is to have a fairly simple, straightforward resolution opposing the petition, and then we will provide more in-depth comments. We also have the assistance of Jim
Ann Olivers,
who helped with the annexation of Falls Creek, as I understand.
Right.
Okay. Did you want to talk about this a bit?
Unless you need me to.
So
you
take the lead. A lot of the communities have already submitted resolutions opposing it. There isn't a strong opposition to the petition itself in Gustavus that I've heard. We're mostly primarily concerned about the overexpansive nature of the boundaries. It's over 10,400 square miles. I think our square mileage is 56 miles. So there's a lot of significance to the vast expanse of the boundaries. It's 60% water, including federal waters. And so we are focusing a lot on the boundaries and also the impact of the what's called enclave, the fact that narrowing that we are would be surrounded by government, basically the Haynesborough and the Park Service, and it would cause us some problems. We also may have financial consequences in the loss of unincorporated boundary land, which provides us with the federal payment in lieu of tax money we get, and the state timberlands. And the combination of those two is, I think, it's about $150 some for pilt and another $40 some thousand for the timber receipts, with over $200,000 a year in our receipts. We have been, despite absolute vigorous attempts by Kathy and I to try and find out what is the potential for our lost acreage and the financial impact, but we don't have that information yet. And I hope that we will find out at some point, because that's obviously something that's going to matter to our budgets in the future if we lose that funding source. The timber receipts, because we don't operate our own school, they're generally used for schools. Ours goes to road maintenance. So losing $46,000 or something in road maintenance would have consequences. So in the resolution, I talk about how in 2019, the first time we were approached, the council opposed the formation of the borough. We were approached again on June 2022 and also declined. It didn't wasn't a resolution. The boundaries, the Huna City has been working on this for a number of years, I think going back to 1995, and each time they come forward, they are able to correct some of the concerns that the local boundary commission has. They go through a screening process with an initial petition, and it has to make it through certain technical review. This is the first time that they have been able to make it through the review. So our public comment is due February 29th, and this is an intent for us to proceed with it. And what I would like I'd like to see the resolution be passed with the consent of the council, that we can then provide more detailed comments to the local boundary commission. Mike, did you want to talk about that a bit as well?
I could. Shelley's put together quite a detailed list of going through the petition and finding statements that they make that we would contest or refute. And just similar to the way that Pelican did, Tenneke had some similar complaints, but they have a much less detailed resolution. The when I discussed it with yesterday with Jim Van Alvorst, he called me to kick around some ideas, and he's looking at their petition from a sort of 30,000 foot level, whereas we looked at a detailed, well, he's read through the whole thing in details, and he sees the kind of things that we're pointing out that we object to. But he said overall, he believes that the petition does not qualify as a borough as is, because the a borough is intended to be a regional government. And we picked up two ideas in our last two whereases that Shelley's resolution here. A borough is intended to be a regional government, and it's supposed to span multiple communities with shared interests, and they're expected to, or the idea of the borough is that multiple communities can work together towards common goals within their region. The Hoonah Borough petition references the Glacier Bay model borough, which included the three communities that are left out of this proposal. And of course notes that the other three communities didn't wish to be included in the proposal. Had the Glacier Bay model borough would meet that in the intent of a borough of being a regional government with multiple communities. But essentially what Hoonah has done with this is try to annex a vast area of land and water to their city. And cities aren't allowed to have within their boundaries to expand their boundaries to cover large areas that are unoccupied or unpopulated. So essentially what they've done is they've expanded their city, but then changed the name to a borough to get around that problem. Jim Van Alvorst doesn't think that's necessarily going to fly with the LBC, and because they are not intending to actually to offer services, and probably the reason that they were happy to leave Pelican, Tanaki, and Gustavus out is they didn't really want to offer services to us. I mean, it's not easy. I can imagine if we were the borough seat and trying to offer services to Hoonah and to the other communities, it would be hard. And so they're trying to construct something that works for them, but they're not paying much attention to what works for us. And the fact that the three communities both feel very much encroached upon, because outside of our city boundaries, we have lands and significant areas that are sort of in our sphere of influence, we could say, but they are areas with resources that we use for business subsistence and recreation and lots of things that are related to our community. And to have those disconnected from our community and entirely under the Hoonah Borough is a problem for all three of the communities. Actually, even for Juneau, because Juneau has objected by resolution to borough boundaries, including the northern end of the Mansfield Peninsula. So, so Jim's primary observation here is that he feels it does not meet the requirement of being a regional government. And no matter how much you shrink the boundaries down, they still have that problem because they're one community and they've got land around them that is not really occupied or populated. So that's kind of an overall high-level complaint about their proposal that may, in fact, shoot it down with the LBC.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things is population. They under the regulation, are required to provide a population of 1,000 if or otherwise make a good argument why that should be allowed to be under 1,000. They have added 49 people in the three communities of Game Creek, Funter Bay, and Elfin Cove. And Jim Van Altvoorst commented on the three municipalities that were excluded, which appears to be for purposes of not having to provide schools. They talk about that to some degree in their petition, that those plus the three small communities that are included would be 50% of the population of the entire region. So it's just, it's a tiny little bit of people that are won't be provided services. At the same time, we're going to have to provide 1% sales tax. There's a lot of questions about how that sales tax is going to be assessed against commercial fishermen and the sport charter, and who knows, even the fuel barges and maybe the people on the Alaska Ferry. There's a whole lot of questions we've got, and the answers are not in the petition itself, which is part of what the local boundary commission looks for. So we will be encouraging people. I mean, the city government, will be taking a position on behalf of as many representatives as we can, but it's also important for the business community and other people to provide their own comments to the local boundary commission. As Jed Smith, staff person, says at every one of his meetings that we don't know what we don't know. So they said, don't assume that if something is missing from the petition, don't assume that we'll know that. We won't know it unless you tell us. So that's another good reason we can provide information again, letting people know how they can submit comments. I'm sorry, Kathy, did you want to? You have your vote.
Yes, the way they're going to tax is so ambiguous right now. We just have no idea, other than what Dennis Gray told Jim Kearns in his email, which was that they would eventually, not the first year, but the second year, have to pay a 1% tax. So when I talked to the Juneau city manager, I asked, wouldn't that impact the same for them out in the waters past? I mean, they're arguing the waters boundaries near the Mansfield Peninsula, but they're not arguing anything else beyond that, which was not in their model borough boundary. And I said, well, they're telling us if we're going to be providing services in the boundary waters that we're going to have to pay a 1% sales tax. Why wouldn't Juneau have to pay that too? And she said, well, because the point of sale is from here. And I said, well, same with us. But I don't know if there's different rules for boroughs who already charge their own tax versus a city that is not part of a borough in the tax. And these are questions that they can't have answered. But when I brought it up with one of their former assembly people, she wanted to know about that. So I sent her the response from Dennis. But it's definitely a question that if they don't have that sorted out, by the time, I mean, that's a very good argument to be making to the Boundary Commission, is nobody knows what that's even going to look like at this point. And who are they going to, are they just cherry picking one region to provide the taxes, or do they have to treat everyone the same, or what does that look like and how does that work? So those are some of my more pressing questions on not enough detail.
Well, there was one other thing that a key point that Jim Van Altvoorst made is that relates to what Kathy, I think, touched on, or Shelley touched on, and is in the resolution here. And that's the idea of enclaves. And they designed it with the idea, so that they could cut us out without us being an enclave or a donut hole within their borough boundary. And so they think that gets around the requirement that you can't have enclaves. But as Van Altvoorst points out, they essentially create enclaves because we are, we and Pelican and Tenneke all have no connection to each other. We could not form our own borough because we would not be contiguous. So essentially, the requirement that the borough not create enclaves may not be satisfied in their petition with the boundaries as drawn. So they would need to pull their boundaries back significantly and at least make it possible for in the future, if Gustavus, Pelican, say Elfin Cove, if it's not in their borough, wanted to be a borough, that we could do it because we would have contiguous connection. But so he thinks that's another disqualifying aspect of their petition.
Yeah. An enclave doesn't have a statutory or regulatory definition that I've been able to find. In fact, in the petition, they quote Merriam-Webster. I did some Googling myself and found that there are other definitions of enclave, meaning that it either it doesn't connect with a road or the extreme financial circumstances to connect up to a road, a public road. So it's the word enclave is pretty much what you make of it. I mean, we would be landlocked, surrounded by government, and that's could be a concern on our ability to grow and maintain our develop our resources.
Right.
Yes.
Well, and Nicole Gruey, who's supposed to be sending us some information, said, you know, just because of the little tiny contiguous pieces of land, she said, for all intents and purposes, it's still a donut hole.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to work at the Boundary Commission. So I'm hoping she's going to give us some good material, too.
Okay. Good. It looks, Tom, looks like you have your, oh, I'm sorry, did you want to
talk? Oh, I'm sorry, did you?
You have your microphone?
Yeah. I would just like to get a copy of that resolution you have.
Sure. I didn't.
In the packet.
Yeah, it'll be in the packet.
It'll be posted. It'll be posted on Wednesday, Thursday at the latest in the draft in the general meeting announcement and packet for next Tuesday.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. I see no further questions or comments. Where are we now? We are.
Oh, Shelley, if you wouldn't, this is Janine. I'm so I really appreciate all of the work you guys have put into this, and I'm just amazed at how organized you are on this. I do wonder, just as listening to what you guys have been, you and Mike have been saying about this idea of the intent, the whereas the borough government is intended to be a regional government. I think that statement says what, you know, that it is intended to be a regional government. But what really was striking to me when you said, in reality, it's just extending their city. And I think that might be a stronger point to think about in that one, the making that point. Because I guess when I read that, I didn't necessarily make that next leap. And that really rings true.
I think that will is something that we can talk about in detail in the extended comments.
Or we could edit it between now and Wednesday. Or,
okay.
Yeah.
And so I was, when they had the presentation on it, I guess I was also struck by, they were saying that it can be approved, it can be disapproved, or it can be modified. And initially, you know, like, I guess I was thinking that most of the comments we were getting kind of went towards the modification of it. But after listening to what you and Mike have said now, I totally understand the reason for opposing it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of the communities are opposing it. Juneau has just gone for a partial opposition to modify the boundary. I think I'm up to about five different boundary modifications that I've seen, which I'll be submitting with the comments, because we don't really know how the local boundary commission will proceed. It may be if they don't feel that they have, or I guess they have a lot of latitude, they have a lot of flexibility, and if they decided that they wanted to grant the borough at this time to Huna, who's been working pretty hard on it for quite a while. But they also saw that there were some real good arguments on behalf of modifying the boundaries, that could be a fallback position. So we're probably going to proceed with both, you know. But
right, because they didn't really explain in those meetings what the procedure was in terms of the modifications. Like, they didn't say who made the modifications or who proposed them or what, if there was a process for, you know, eventually then approving the modifications. I was left with a lot more questions after they mentioned how it can be, you know, there's three options, and they didn't go into much detail into what the modification option would look like.
I can.
Oh, go ahead.
Maybe I can address this. The way I understand it works, Janine, they've made their petition the way they think qualifies. If the LBC goes through it in detail, which would be the staff person, Jed Smith's primary job, to go through it and identify any shortcomings, then he or the LBC board would recommend or would set requirements for things that had to be changed. And then if HUNA agrees to those requirements, and modifies their petition so it is acceptable to the LBC, then it can go out for comment again and for public hearing in HUNA and eventually for a vote. So the LBC has to be satisfied that the design of the borough as described in the petition meets the requirements for incorporation of a borough under statute and under the Constitution.
Thank you.
All right. I don't see any further question. We'll move forward. This is item number 13, approved resolution to establish a lands advisory committee. Back in 20 and February of 20, and Kathy just recently came across these emails, where this has to do with the Native Conservancy and the Gustavus Four Lands and the HUNA Indian Association making a proposal to assume ownership of the lands. And the we found out Kathy was found emails in Tom Williams, the former administrator's files, where there was a discussion between the Nature Conservancy and Tom about, he basically was saying it wasn't a firm offer, but he was basically offering Gustavus the opportunity to take over the land. So they talked about having a committee, council committee, to start looking into it. And then COVID came along, and that seemed to have fallen off the path. It never did come to the council, as far as I can tell. I don't see any report from Tom about this. And then about 21 is when the HUNA Indian Association approached a Nature Conservancy and said that they were interested in the lands. I'm not sure that Ivy, the director who has been there, I think about 18 months, she may not have been aware that the Nature Conservancy had taken a different proposal. I mean, because basically the Gustavus has been the stewards of the land for, you know, a couple of decades now. So I seem to have annoyed people by writing her and saying, we would like to, we're interested in picking up on this and pursuing this. And we're thinking what we could do while this thing is sort of, if what they originally wanted was to have a committee of council members and people engaged in, you know, developing a plan and a proposal, we're thinking, well, perhaps we can go ahead and get that started, in which case I handed this off to Mike. So who does all the work? I get all the credit.
A little bit of it. When we spoke with Ivy in that meeting, I asked her if we could begin to work with TNC more actively to manage the land. And so that was one thing that I had in mind behind this, that I think many of us felt that we'd kind of taken our Four Lands Preserve for granted and its safety for granted. And then we kind of had a shock when we found out that maybe we could have lost it in this deal. And so I think many of us felt that we need to be more actively involved as a city in at least co-management of the property with them, at least working on things like management plans, and are there roles that they'd like the city to do with regard to assuring the protection of the lands and so forth. And those that sort of partnership was called out in the realty agreement in 2003 or whatever it was. There was the expectation that we would do that, but we'd never actually followed up on it. So so I think the idea here was, number one, to use that the fact that they had made that overture to us in 2000 that didn't get followed up on, in part because of the pandemic and everything, where they were offering it, offering the lands to us to be the conservation owner, that if we said, okay, let's talk about that, then that puts us on the record as being very much in interest of taking responsibility for the lands if it ever is transferred from TNC. So the idea of having a committee actually came to me from various people who talked to me at the time when this was all boiling over, Kathy Strebler for one of them, who said we need a committee to assure the protection of the lands and to work on management issues with them and make sure that we're meeting our requirements and that we're in the driver's seat or we're prepared to take them if TNC decides they no longer wish to be the managing owner. So a lands committee, as we wrote this resolution up, is actually generally related or generally written, so it doesn't necessarily apply. It doesn't apply only to the TNC lands, but the city, of course, has other lands that the lands committee could deal with, the beach property, the harbor, the gravel pits, and so forth are all city lands that we could use an advisory committee to think through some of the issues on and make recommendations for. But the idea was primarily to have a committee set up that the mayor could then assign the primary task of working with TNC and identifying shared goals with TNC, perhaps opportunities for co-management of the lands that would make sure that we're there working with them. And if they change their ownership views, then we're in the position to for them to transfer it to us, not to somebody else.
Thank you, Mike. All right. Do we have a copy that can be posted on the screen? It's not part of the packet.
I did not have the proposed resolution prior to sending out this packet. Mm-hmm. I'll make sure that it's in for the general meeting.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions or comments about proceeding with the resolution?
Janine has her hand raised.
Okay, thank you, Janine.
Yes, and so I'm thinking along the lines and some of the input that we got, and in terms of the importance of the fact that HUNA did reach out and have wanting to have some interest in those lands. And I think it would be in our best interest to reach our hands across the water and ask for some input and to open a dialogue with them. I think it's really unfortunate that this is coming on the heels of the borough thing, which is maybe muddling some of the, I don't know, ruffling feathers as well as this is. But I do think that, you know, it would be, I would recommend that the committee reach out to HUNA and start a dialogue so that we know what we're talking, what they're talking about and what they're interested in. And we can then react in a way with knowledge as opposed to with fear.
That sounds okay.
And then I have one other thought along with it is you're talking of a committee and you're talking of the various lands and the gravel pits and the beach. And it starts to get to be like land and our use of it, including the roads as land, is a huge part of what the city does and manages. And I know that suggesting that we put more work onto city employees is not something we can really do because I realize that they're got lots on their plates. And I realize though that the suggestion perhaps of another employee or at least consultant isn't always welcomed, but it's seeming to me that these are huge things that need to have the responsibility of someone who is committed to as an employee or as a paid person, as opposed to a committee that gets a lot of energy right now as it's something really new and important. But my fear is that over time that fades away. And then the same thing happens as to what happened now is that it's not on anyone's front burner. So no one's really responsible for it. And so 3 years or 5 years or whatever down the road, we end up in the same position. And so I would suggest that we consider having it be something that is a paid position or a consult or something like that, that we put it on the table to think about. Do we really want it all to be on a volunteer basis, or is this something important enough that as a city, we want to pay an employee to manage it?
I guess my feeling is that if there's not the energy to proceed with it, there may not be an interest in the community. I kind of think that we're sort of sort of explaining my concept of government is that it's from the bottom up, not the top down. I would rather that people are very passionate about things here that they're interested in, and I don't think I'd want to just hand it off, maybe make another staff position, because there's not enough energy in the community to maintain it. You want to stop?
Well, I think our resolution notes that we don't have a staff person assigned to managing lands. Mm-hmm. And so lacking a staff person, we could revert to an advisory committee. You may remember that we started out the city with advisory committees running just about everything. And we had committees for the DRC. Janine was on it with me for one. We had a road committee. We had a fire board, we had a library committee and so forth that all kind of managed the functions. And we have, as we've matured, we have moved to having paid staff for those positions. And I think it's where possible that it certainly has its benefits because then you have somebody who's actually getting paid to do the work and is responsible and accountable for it. But I don't know that we're to where we can persuade the population here, our voters, that we need another position for this now. But maybe after the committee has done some work, it could come up with a recommendation that would be worthwhile, and we'd have to look at the budget and all of that at the time. But adding another, we've always been fairly conservative about adding positions, and we would have to be here as well.
Jim Makoviak.
Yeah, I think it would be a good idea to confine this committee's activities to TNC lands in Gustavus.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that can be done, and maybe a committee could actually do. Thanks.
Jim, it does. The way the resolution is written, it says the mayor will assign the topics and priorities. So my guess is that they would be assigned only the TNC thing initially, but we left it broader. So for other applications in the future, if that was desirable, but the mayor can certainly control that. And I think that would be advisable, as you say.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Does anyone else want to comment? Oh, Kathy?
This is sort of late breaking news. I don't know if you've seen it, but so via our person who helped us get the CrossIt grant for the playground equipment, his wife is the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Land Trust. And she heard through the rumor mill of our dilemma here with some of this. And she is suggesting that we could speak with the Southeast Alaska Land Trust people. And that way, I mean, I know people want to keep the four lands, you know, in conservation, but there's a lot of folks who don't like the default would be for the city to have it if there was no other, if TNC didn't want to keep it under their jurisdiction anymore. This might be a good alternative to us not dealing with it, but it would still be in some sort of conservation program, but we would have to know what that was and what it looked like. And she is offering up for us to have a look-see with them. So I think that's a really good opportunity to seize, to see what they're about. And it may satisfy people who would not like to see it owned by the city, but still under a conservation.
And I think someone else mentioned them to me as well.
Yep.
As a possible. That's a really good.
So I responded to her. We'll see what, you know, we'll obviously need to have a meeting with them. But I do agree that Jim's idea of keeping it specific just to this issue at this point would be prudent.
I think the concern was that if we called it, you know, the TNC committee or the Savis Four Lands committee, it might further inflame the passions of the opposing parties. And so we were sort of trying to be generic.
So I have a question on that in terms of the having the other organization, land management. Is there a possibility that it could be a co-management type of an agreement where any change to the covenants or whatever, the way that it's all written, has to be approved by both parties, or something that instead of handing it off to some other entity, that the city has a role in terms of a co-management and decision-making?
Well, this is only about an hour and a half old, so I wouldn't know what the parameters would be at this point, but that would certainly be worth speaking about if and when there was a meeting about it.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking along those lines, that it would be something to suggest.
And Jim, did you have further comment?
Yeah, just information here. Jesse Keel's office contacted me last week and wanted to know about the TNC TNC issue here, and I forwarded to them a bunch of documents. And that's where things stand.
Okay. All right. Well, it looks like we can move on to council reports. And Kyle, would you like to tell us about coffee with council?
Sure, yeah. So we'll kind of start just giving a brief overview of the process, and Rachel and I are both kind of bouncing off some notes before finalizing a report that we'll submit to Liesl by tomorrow, Liesl. I'm not sure who thought this was a good idea, but they were ruthless. I'm totally kidding. It was awesome. It was great. We gained a lot of really good info on a lot of tough topics, a lot of the stuff that we're talking about in our meetings. There wasn't a lot of holding back, but it was very close, informal, comfortable. I think a lot of people felt comfortable to speak their mind. We kind of let them lead it. We had some prompt questions, and you know, it was as advertised, and we had a few questions that we were able to just give kind of basic fact-based clarification without getting into too much projection on, you know, the council's thoughts or even our individual thoughts. There are times where that would happen. I think we both did a pretty good job of clarifying that if we provided anything that was sort of subjective, that it was our thoughts alone, but we try to stay away from a lot of that and do a lot of gathering of information. You know, we talked about a lot of the touchy topics, TNC, borough stuff. We asked a couple of questions about city-run departments and how people feel, and got a lot of good info. I think it was very well received. I think it felt kind of like one of those projects that you have the materials for in your garage and you sit there for months waiting for the time, and then it takes you half a day to knock it out and you wonder why it took you so long to do it. Mm-hmm. Seemed like it wasn't a very heavy lift, but it went a long way, and I would really like for us to continue to do this. I think at least for the, you know, 20, 25 people that attended, give or take, I think at one point I counted there was a little over 20. There were even some people kind of waiting outside over by the counter that would then shuffle in as a couple people left. It was very well received. We got a lot of praise just for doing it in and of itself. And yeah, so we will put together a little bit more detail in our report that we send over to Liesl and have that in the packet next week. But I think it went over really well.
Rachel, I thought it was a lot of fun as well, and I heard a lot of good feedback, and it was a, like Kyle said, it was a very comfortable setting, and it was more kind of like a round table discussion of everybody kind of bouncing ideas off of each other and answering each other's questions, and it was really cool to see and be a part of.
Good. Well, thank you both. It was a great idea, and it sounds like you accomplished what you intended to achieve, and we look forward to having future opportunities. Did people indicate how frequently they'd like these meetings?
There were a couple of people that asked, and we just kind of said what we said when we pitched the idea to the council, that we're hoping, you know, somewhere in the region of quarterly, but not necessarily beholden to that to make it a burden for the council to do, but just encouraging doing it regularly. And so I don't know, maybe after the first one, that's something that we can discuss as a council, if we want to make it a little bit more rigid on when and how, just so it doesn't become one of those things that we had this great idea to do once and Rachel and I do it once or twice and then it kind of tapers off over time. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like as often as we would do it, people would attend. So
okay. All right. Well, I see no other hands raised, and I'm not going to give a mayor's report tonight. We will meet again on Tuesday. Does anybody else want to have any closing comments before we adjourn?
It's a week from Tuesday for general meeting, a week from Tuesday.
General meeting next Tuesday.
Right? Week from tomorrow.
From tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think Kathy has something she wants to
do. Also this evening, not that long ago, I got a call from Barb Miranda, and the Forest Service is doing an update to their long-term planning, and they're visiting communities, and she wants to have it's their forest plan review and their in revision, and they want to have a meeting here on Thursday, April 4th with the community. So we talked about whether we should have it here or if it would be bigger to have it at the community center. She's going to check with them, but they do want to have a lot of public input on the Forest Service plan revision.
Did she say when they'll have a draft out for review?
No, okay. She just is going to send me an email about the process, and but she wants to have it on April 4th.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thanks, everybody. See you next Tuesday.
Thanks.
Hey, Liesl.
Thank you, Ben and Kyle, for taking care of the tech on that side. Appreciate it. And Ben, you'll have to shut it down from City Hall.
Ben left.
He did not. I can see him in the window.